Hello and welcome to the Albion Obsessed podcast. Today we come to you on the back of a last day defeat to Aston Villa at Villa Park, a game that was ultimately a bit of a dead rubber for us, but our opposition were well up for it, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But before we do, let's see who we've got on the podcast today. We welcome Joe. Joe, my friend, how are you doing? For the last couple of weeks, you've been saying you just want the season to end, and now it is over. How does that make you feel?
And now I am sad. I don't want the season to end. No, where's football gone? We do have the Women's World Cup to look forward to, so I'm very much looking forward to that. I'm feeling good, Tom. Feeling excited. I've got my house move in 4 or 5 days' time. Everything's looking positive, even though we lost yesterday. So, feeling weirdly good.
Very good, very good. We also welcome our American correspondent, Dagan. Dagan, my friend, how are you keeping?
Doing well, Tom. I am, however, in mourning, so I'm wearing the black shirt today. Sad for this glorious season to be over. I have so much gratitude for all of you and just every Brighton fan and every piece of the club that has made this just, you know, one of the most memorable sports experiences of my life. I don't know if I'll make it to the end of year wrap-up, but it's been incredible. So I'm just feeling gratitude, but obviously this tinge of sadness that it's over for now. Excited to get to see the club in person for the first time this summer, though. Cheers.
Yeah, man. It's one of those, don't be sad that it's over, be happy that it happened. But no, I totally get you, because it's been a monumental season. And a man that has covered it from the start to the finish is Richie Mills. We welcome back Richie onto the podcast. Richie, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, thanks. And thanks a lot for having me on. How are you guys?
Yeah, doing really well, thank you, mate. It's like one of those things, as we said, like for weeks, it's just been a case of getting across the line. And now the line has been crossed and the season is over. I'm just a bit disappointed. I've got nothing to do for 2 months now. What am I going to do on my weekends? I just don't know.
Just really quickly on that point. So I asked De Zerbi after the game, like, what's the plans now? Like, what do you do? Because obviously he works tirelessly and is always thinking about football and he dreams about football. And so he said, the season is finished and that is bad news for me because it is difficult without football. I will go back to Italy, my country. I will work with Tony and the club to improve the squad to prepare for the new season. The season was fantastic and we have to try and repeat that this next season. So yeah, he's probably going to be going back to Italy to find out more stuff about football.
Yeah, you know what? And that doesn't surprise me at all. Someone with his sort of passion and commitment and work ethic, it doesn't surprise me at all that he lives, breathes and eats. You know, football is life for him. And I'm sure he won't actually do too much resting. So before we dive into the podcast, Richie, sad news for yourself. You've put out on Twitter today that you'll be leaving Sussex Live. Tell us, Richie, you know, how did that come about? Is it something, and have you got anything left in the pipeline that's sort of like for future projects?
So I found out at the end of March, so yeah, just over two months ago, that Reach PLC, the company that I've worked for more than four and a half years, were laying off 200 people across the UK. It's a bit weird because I actually initially got this job in September 2020 from mass redundancies. I was working in news journalism in the southwest of England for a number of years, and there was 500 redundancies at that time, and then they randomly posted an internal vacancy. Funny enough, one was Brighton, another was Watford, and another was Crystal Palace. And I was recommended for the Brighton one. So there you go. But yeah, so it's come full circle, sadly, and redundancies have kicked me in the hiney. And so yesterday was my last shift. Initially, we were a bit worried because we weren't going to actually see out the season, which would have been, I think, a big mistake just because of Brighton's incredible season. I think the optics would have been pretty bad. No, I think initially I would have stopped before the Arsenal game. So, yeah, that wouldn't have looked great. It's not been the funnest time. It's, you know, you're trying to work and do, you know, cover the season, but then you've got this kind of big baggage going on back of your mind and thinking, oh, God, how am I going to got a mortgage and all that stuff? And, yeah, so, but It's been an incredible season. I've loved the, you know, nearly three seasons covering the club, you know, getting to go to games, press conferences, getting to the managers and the team. It's been like a dream recently, you know, just to, you know, if you're not good enough to play sport, I think the next best thing is to report on it. So yeah, it's been a fantastic few years. Hopefully got some stuff in the pipeline freelance wise, still looking for like a permanent gig, just to have a bit more security. But yeah, I would love to cover Brighton again because it's such a great club and, you know, I've built up some really good contacts and, you know, decent following. I'm very, very grateful for that. So hopefully this is not the end. But if it is, I've been very, very fortunate.
Well, I think I speak for everyone. I think I speak for everyone connected with Brighton and Albion, whether that be fans, people that you've spoken to and had contact with, that, you know, your coverage has been fantastic. One of the very best out there, and people would be silly not to take you on. So just want to say thanks. And hopefully it's not the end. So yeah, fair play to you, Richie.
Thanks so much, guys. That's very, very nice. Yeah. But let's talk about Brighton, that's more important.
Richie, just before we do that, I wondered if you wouldn't mind sharing maybe one of your highlights that you've covered as you've covered Brighton for a couple of years now. Which moment to you has perhaps stood out above the rest?
Unfortunately, it's not going to be a De Zerbi era moment. It's the Brighton comeback against Manchester City with Big Dan Burn hooking the goal with his telescopic legs to come back to 3-2. That was just, I think, because that was obviously, I'd cover the whole season without fans. And then to have fans back for the first time properly, I think there was a couple of thousand for maybe a Southampton defeat, the 2-1, I think, loss in like December 2020. But to have fans back in May of 2021, I think it was maybe 7,000 or 8,000, but I was just amazed by the sheer noise that, you know, a quarter or so of the stadium could make. It was, it was just fantastic. And yeah, to come back against the all-conquering City was fantastic. It was one of those moments where I just felt so lucky to be there, just thinking, this is nuts. Like, I'm just, like, I get, this is my job. Like, I get to report on this. This is just ridiculous. How have I managed to come my way in? That was really good. That was probably the standout moment. But yeah, also getting to know De Zerbi. He's such a character. Obviously, you know, people aren't so much a fan of Potter these days, and I guess that's very understandable. He was very, very nice, but I just think De Zerbi just got the fans from the get-go, just, you know, heart on his sleeve. He really has a way with words, even though, you know, he's not completely fluent in English. He just gets it. I think one of my favourite quotes of his was after, I can't remember who they beat, it might have been Liverpool, and he just says, you know, in football you need blood, heart and balls. And I was just like, this guy. He gets it. So yeah, plenty of highlights, but yeah, I'd say the City comeback would be number one.
Yeah, that's a very fair moment to comment on, because it was one of those moments where unbelievable, and your use of the word telescopic to describe Dan Burn's leg is also absolutely spot on as well. So let's dive into it then, gentlemen. Let's talk about the Aston Villa game. As I've already said, you know, it was a bit of a dead rubber for us in that we'd already secured our top six finish. We'd already secured Europa League, whereas Aston Villa were very much still chasing down the Conference League, needing to better or match Spurs' result, sorry. So let's talk about the starting 11 then, Joe. And let's talk about a man who got his first Premier League start in Yassin Ayari, who started alongside Alexis McAllister. Now, Joe, I don't know if you heard, but I think it was on Five Live, they were talking about Ayari being almost like the successor to Alexis McAllister. So do you think this was a good opportunity for him, as it would be the last, probably the last opportunity to learn alongside Alexis McAllister?
Yeah, I think what we have seen of Iari, given it's a very small sample size of the quality he possesses, it's really exciting to see, you know, what he can do. I think the fans need to be extremely patient. We need to give him a lot of time. And yeah, I think he could be another one of those players in the ranks who comes through and shines for us. You know, I think he's already had two international starts for Sweden's first team. So that's no mean feat at all. So yeah, hopefully we see more of Yasin, because as I say, been really impressed so far. So yeah, fingers crossed for better things in the future for him.
Another one of those youngsters that Brighton seemed to have just plucked out of nowhere, thrown into a starting 11 for in the Premier League. Absolute scenes. Dagan, you know, just touching there upon Alexis McAllister, and we will talk about him a bit more a bit later. But in all likelihood, this is probably going to, well, it was probably Alexis McAllister's last game. I mean, he's been one hell of a servant to the club. What have you made of his season under Roberto De Zerbi and Graham Potter?
Well, the thing that struck me about McAllister, and I know I said this maybe one of the first times I ever had a chance to comment about Brighton publicly, he has swagger. He just doesn't back down from anybody. He's always in the mix. If there's ever a confrontation, he's in it. And he had the persona of a World Cup winner before he was a World Cup winner, right? And then I think what he brought to us was sort of that, you know, authenticity of, like, we have a World Cup winner starter alongside, you know, Messi, who they were buds, they were friends, like, and he's here playing for Brighton. And I think it you know, furthered our legitimacy after the World Cup, even though we knew who we were. I think the world, you know, saw us on a slightly different level, not only with McAllister, but bringing back all the World Cup players that we did, but in particular a champion. And he carried himself like one throughout, and just, you know, a lot of class, a lot of dignity, but and a lot of quality. We've talked a lot about, you know, his positional versatility and where we like him better or not. Today is probably not a day for that. You know, just seems to be a class person, and the way he's handled this, you know, I wish he wasn't going. I don't, you know, sounds like Liverpool. If he goes to City, I guess I understand. If he goes to Liverpool, I sort of shrug my shoulders and think, why, other than he's going to make a lot of money, I guess. But he'll be missed. But I think, you know, Ayari, and for me, Buonanotte, I want to see him in that 10 spot. I really want to see him in that 10 spot. And I know Pedro can operate there. Let's not get ahead to next year, but I'm already sort of in my head moving. But no, it's going to be a sad parting made sadder if both of that double pivot makes its way.
Yeah, no, tell me about it. We will talk about that a bit later in the podcast, the possibility of losing both our two star men in the midfield. But before we get on to that, Rich, let's talk about another star man in midfield who yesterday played at left back, Pascal Gross, Mr. Versatility. Pascal has been sensational this season. He wore the captain's armband yesterday, and he was deployed at left back. What did you make of that selection there?
I mean, I didn't actually think he had the best game. But, you know, he can do what he wants. You know, I was actually talking about this with another journalist. You could probably have five or six players who you could make an argument for being Brighton player of the season. And I think Gross is definitely in that. I mean, yeah, I've asked De Zerbi about him in the past, and he said that Gross is like the secret of Brighton. He's got that experience. He's got that versatility. He can play based on any single position. I think he even joked that you could probably have a go in goal. Yeah, he's just an unbelievable servant to Brighton. And yeah, it's great that obviously he signed his new deal not that long ago for a couple more years. And yeah, I'd always go back to the point that, you know, he cost, I think, 3 million from Ingolstadt in 2017. And I think he's actually level now with Glenn Murray and Neil Mopay for Brighton's top Premier League scorer. So I'd love to see him get that record. I was actually, during the Southampton game, Glenn Murray was in the press lounge, and he was, I've never kind of chatted to him. I've never been bold enough to go up to say hello. I was tempted to ask him, like, how do you feel? Because obviously you get some people who are quite, no, I want to keep my record. And then some go, oh, it's fine, you know. Blah, blah, blah. But yes, Pascal Gross, it would be, he for for me, obviously, I don't know near as much about Brighton as you guys, but he's a Brighton legend, I'd say. So for him to be top of the pile, that would be pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think Glenn Murray famously once, when asked, how have you scored so many goals in the Premier League with Brighton? I think he famously replied, Pascal Gross. So, you know, it shows the level of respect that Glenn has for Pascal and what he's done for this club. So, Joe, we've seen this before. We've seen Brighton travel to Villa Park on the last day of the season. But how nice was it knowing that the result didn't really affect us any more than our pride, as it were? How freeing was that?
Yeah, it was such a wonderful few days after the City game where we could just sort of put our feet up, relax, watch football with no anxiety, because before we'd confirmed our European spot, I couldn't really watch any football because it was just making me unbelievably anxious. Everything reminded me that we needed to get these points and we needed to finish this before we went to Villa on the final day, because, as you say, Tom, severe PTSD. So yeah, it was so nice to, I watched the Bundesliga final day on Saturday, and then to sit there and watch the Premier League final day unfold and the playoffs and everything like that. It's just, yeah, just such a weird feeling to know that we can watch a Brighton game with literally no worries at all. And I don't think I've had that feeling for ever, really. I can't really think back to when we haven't needed something towards the end of the season. You could maybe possibly argue the promotion season because we'd already got our target, but obviously we were fighting for the league title. And some fans are bothered by that, some aren't. I'm one that I'm not really bothered because we've made this journey, and had we have won the championship, would it have put more pressure on us to perform in the Premier League? Maybe. Of course, hindsight is an amazing thing, but yeah, just a really weird feeling to be sitting there watching football and not caring.
Now you've mentioned it, Joe, I think the last time I genuinely went into the end of a season not really caring too much was the second season with Poyet, because that was the season I think we'd already confirmed playoffs, and it was just sort of about having a lovely time and trying to make sure that we finished fourth.
Was that against Wolves, and we relegated Wolves?
Yeah, that was nice free-flowing football, and there was no pressure on us at all. But every season after that, I just think, you know, Oscar Garcia, it was about getting the playoffs. The year after that, it was about survival. The year after that, it was playoffs. The year after that, it was trying to get the title, and then the year after that, survival. And, you know, so I think that might have been the last time that it was a genuinely carefree end to the season, for us, at least. Not the same could be said about our opponents, Dagan. Now, my Villa supporting friends wanted me to mention this, because I do, and I think it's kudos to them. Villa started the season, and they were 3 points off of relegation. They were 3 points off the bottom three. And they went into the last day fighting for European football. And you could see in the early stages how much it meant to them and how on the front foot they really are. Because under Unai Emery, that's just the sort of side they are. And in the very early exchanges, they hit the crossbar. How evident was it that this Villa team were fired up?
It was incredibly evident that they were fired up. And I think throughout the game, they were intent on being physical. Nothing was going to be easy for us. And for a team that really didn't have a lot of reason to have a ton of will to be desperate to score goals on our side, for them to bring that level of physicality was noticeable. What was also noticeable is from the beginning of the game, and the commentators made note of it, we seemed highly agitated by how they were playing, by the referee. You know, there were a couple times where we, you know, fairly early in the game had four or five, maybe even six guys around the official, uncharacteristic of us, right? I mean, we will protest, and maybe it was the absence of Dunk, that, you know, they're used to Dunk sort of clearing everybody, and his big physical presence sort of does that. Also, Gross struck me as way more agitated as the captain than he normally does. So like he felt, you know, a degree of I have to carry that mantle. And I think McAllister in particular wanted this game. He wanted to leave on a win. And I think he was, think he made some, he was maybe too in his emotions throughout the game, engaged in a lot of, you know, a lot of physicality, got a lot of mix-ups and a lot of arguments, just seemed overly amped up the whole time. And when he did get some chances, he just, you know, didn't make the most of them. To Villa's credit, they were dialed in. I will say, when was it Ramsey that missed the easy, easy one? He somehow blasted it over from point blank range. I watched the game yesterday with a good friend who's a Villa fan, a longtime Villa fan. And I'll be candid. I wanted Spurs to finish eighth more than I wanted us to win this game. And so if I was watching it and Leeds was up, I obviously would have been cheering, you know, vociferously for us to, you know, wrestle a tie out of this game. But as it was, I was like, well, you know what? It's okay, because this is going to hurt Spurs, and I'm happy with that, which it sounds so terrible to say.
Not at all.
That's football. That's football.
No, after what happened when we played Spurs at their place, I too desperately wanted Villa to pip them to the European spot, because I think that was an absolute travesty. I think it was a crime against football. So I am really, really, really happy that Spurs didn't make Europe. I don't know which I'm more happy about, Spurs not making Europe or Leeds getting relegated. It's kind of in the air about that, because, yeah, Leeds. Mm. But let's talk about Spurs then, Richie, because obviously, as I've already sort of alluded to, you know, Villa had to match or better Spurs results. If Spurs won, they had to win. Spurs went one up in, what, 2 minutes? What was the reaction like inside Villa Park when that happened?
I think, to be fair, I was a bit worried about this one, because right from, well, before the game, there was a really, really good atmosphere. And I was thinking, uh-oh, this is going to be Newcastle away vibes. The crowd were pretty raucous, you know, it was a febrile atmosphere. I just felt that this is a case of Villa are going to start really fast and they're going to want to keep it in their hands. And I don't think there was only really for me, I don't think it sort of trickled through that Spurs had taken the lead. They were just, for the first few minutes, they were really, really singing to the rafters. And yeah, I think they were definitely the better team earlier on. Brighton didn't help themselves. They made some mistakes, even like, you know, Steele was making some fairly sloppy passes. I thought, I don't want to criticise him too harshly, because it was his, you know, his full Premier League debut, but I thought Ayari was a little bit lightweight in midfield, but he wasn't particularly helped by McAllister, who didn't have the best game, as I think Dagan said. They won that midfield battle. You know, the likes of McGinn, Kamara, and Louise were fantastic. McGinn especially. They were like, you know, a snarling pack of wolves, just kind of really just constantly, you know, harrying and harassing and Brighton. And I think they struggled to respond to that. But there was definitely nerves later on in the game when Brighton came back into it and deservedly got a goal. And I was really happy to see Dennis Undav, who coincidentally is my favourite Brighton player to interview, because he's very, very honest and candid and gives some really good stuff. So it's really good to see him score, I think, 5 goals in his last 8 games. So yeah, he looked really, really good. Very, very clinical. Very unlucky to have that goal ruled out for offside from Enciso's cross, who was also a very good performer on the day. So yeah, I think Villa, yeah, they wanted to start fast. They did. Brighton weren't quite at the races. And it was a bit of a shame, because I think Brighton gave it to them a little bit. I don't think Villa massively earned it, but to be fair, they capitalized when the chances came their way. But yeah, main thing is Brighton's sick for Europa League.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's one of those situations where we can't be too mad that we lost, really. Because for us, as I say, it was a bit of a dead rubber. Accusations of players already being on the beach. And it probably was a bit too easy, wasn't it, Joe, for Villa, for their first goal especially. We gave the ball away almost at halfway. Villa counter really quickly. They go into the box. It's a nice little cut back to Louise, who side foots in from 12 yards. I mean, disappointing goal to concede, but Did you sort of, I mean, I know it sounds terrible, but normally we'd be quite cross with that. We'd be like, right, poor on possession, poor defending, should have done better. But because it was the last day, nothing riding on it, did you care as much? Be honest.
No. And I know that's, you know, a lot of diehard Brighton fans are going to be like, oh, how could you? It's a goal against Brighton. What are you saying? But yeah, I mean, it's a goal against my team. Of course, it hurt. You know, you never want to see a goal scored against your own team. And I thought, you know, Douglas Luiz was given so much space. It was ridiculous. Like, I don't think there was a player within an 8-yard circle around him, and he was just free to slot it into the bottom corner. Is what it is, Tom. Not sorry to bring up the Graham Potter quote, but is what it is.
We'll learn from it. We'll take the positives.
We're all human beings.
More frustrating for me was we seemed really undisciplined. I felt like there were so many offsides. I feel like if De Zerbi's upset about anything, it's the number of times we were flagged offside. A couple of times just by the slimmest of margins, costing us some goals. But that seemed really uncharacteristic to me, the number of times that we just sort of had that mental lapse. Villa keeps a really, really high line all the time. But that's, that was the thing that stood out to me. The second goal, man, I mean, McGinn just picked McAllister's pocket. It was a really nice tackle. At first, I was like, you know, ready to exclaim that there was a foul. And then I saw the other angle. I was like, ooh, that was nicely done.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, let's talk about the second goal then. McAllister went down on the touchline and he was very intent after the goal was stood to show the referee his ankle. And the referee was just like, no, I'm not interested, which I found to be quite, I don't know. We'll talk about a bit more about the referees a little bit later. But no, it was a very quick counter and it was a nice, easy finish. Ollie Watkins with a tap in, really. So really disappointing. But Richie, I mean, in your opinion, was that tackle from McGinn a foul or not?
My first instinct was no. I think I was a little bit more on the fence after seeing the replay. But yeah, I mean, that's the point that I guess both Brighton's goals came from mistakes. Like, I think Webster tried to pass the ball out and it wasn't a particularly good pass. And then a few seconds later, they score. And then same thing with McAllister. I think you made some really good points about he was maybe just a bit too amped on, maybe he's thinking that he wants one last hurrah or something. Yeah, I think it was no coincidence that when sort of Caicedo came on, Brighton had a bit more parity in that midfield battle. So, yes, just thinking about a Brighton midfield about those two. But anyway, that's sort of...
Yeah, it's not worth thinking about, at least at the moment.
Joe's checking out.
Yeah, man, I don't. Yeah, we'll talk a bit more about, like, let's say, the midfield conundrum a bit later. So, Villa obviously went 2-2. I mean, before they did go 2-2, we have to talk about Undav's seeming equaliser, because it was a lovely finish. But Enciso, unfortunately, offside. It was tight, but it was correct. Joe, Undav did eventually have a goal given to him in that game. But it goes to show him he is a clinical finisher. And many fans had already written him off. But as Richie has already said in this podcast, 5 goals in 8 games. It's a decent return.
It's a massive return. It's so good. I've never been so happy for a Brighton player to come good. And of course, I want every single Brighton player to be good. But the amount of crap that has come towards Dennis Undav in the last few months has been ridiculous. This is a guy that, who I believe has been through a little bit of family issues and has come off the back of that and maybe has had his focus elsewhere, which is completely fair enough, and has come back into the team, has fought his way into the team and has scored, as Richie says, 5 goals in 8 games. It's phenomenal. And Ryan Adset put out yesterday, Dennis Undav is clinical, and he is. He's such a good finisher. And maybe that wasn't evident in the, you know, when he hit the post three times or whatever it was. I can't remember who that was against.
Bournemouth?
The boys work so, yes, that's it. But he's worked so hard, and I'm so happy for him. And I really, really hope that he can be a huge part of next season and you know, rival that striker spot with Evan Ferguson, or even start alongside Evan Ferguson.
Yeah, I was just about to jump in there, Joe, in regards to that, because obviously we know that Alexis McAllister over the last few months has played as that 10. And almost when I always think that when De Zerbi sets up, when we attack, we almost look like a 4-2-4, and that central attacking midfielder often pushes very high up to, you know, to partner with the striker. And he's Undav's played that a couple of times now, alongside Welbeck, and yesterday alongside Ferguson. So I do think he's, you know, that could be a role that we see him in more next season, personally. But no, you're right, Joe. The clinical nature of his finishing recently has been exceptional. And the goals that he scored, you know, against, was it Wolves when he did the chip? And then the Arsenal goal. The man's obviously got class and he knows where the net is. So I think perhaps fans wrote him off a bit too soon. Too soon. Yeah. And two 100%. Nice finishes yesterday. Just a shame about the first one being chalked off for offside. But it was the right call. Right call. No arguments here. The truth is, Dagan, I think Brighton had plenty of opportunities in that first half to win. Ferguson had two good chances from what I can remember. Both times probably should have done a lot better. Undav as well probably could have scored towards the end of the half to make it 2-2, but was denied by Martinez, I think. So Brighton had their opportunities, didn't they?
Undoubtedly. The ball that McAllister played through to Ferguson on a run, I thought was the play of the game for us. I mean, that was just put on a plate. And uncharacteristically, Ferguson did not make the most of those two really good chances that he had. Undoff had another couple of good looks. He had one in the second half. He pulled the trigger sort of inexplicably early in what was like a half pass, half shot that just went way wide. Yeah, I mean, we certainly had chances. Just that is the way the game goes sometimes. Villa, you know, Villa, again, sitting with the Villa fan, they had a similar number of disappointing efforts around the goal as well. And we also had other pretty horrific giveaways that didn't end up biting us. I mean, the aforementioned play that I talked about, where the ball came across to Ramsey right in front of the net. That was a horrific pass by Steele. He couldn't have passed it to them any better. But again, he had a pretty solid effort throughout the rest of the game. But yeah, we had chances. It's hard. It's just hard to feel bad. Spurs are eighth.
Exactly. And that's why I'm not overly angry that we didn't take those chances. There is one more thing I just wanted to talk about, Richie, in regards to the Villa game before we talk about sort of like the wider end of the season stuff. And that is young Hinchelwood coming on for his first team debut. Jack Hinchelwood, 18 years of age, son of former Brighton defender Adam Hinchelwood, who's, I think, is he the Worthing head coach? So, I mean, what a moment. The Hinchelwood name is renowned in Brighton. So a great moment for the youngster to get his debut.
Yeah, it was obviously it's a shame that he didn't maybe get a little bit longer. Yeah, it's a fantastic achievement for him. He's been on the bench a number of times. I actually asked about Hinchelwood to De Zerbi a couple of months ago. I didn't actually end up using it for an article, so I can actually tell it to you guys. Put it to good use. So he said, yeah, so I basically, because that was a time when he'd, you know, he'd been in the squad and, you know, I think at that time he might have been 17. So, you know, still school age type thing. But yeah, so he said he's a good player. He's very, very young, born in 2005, but he knows the right way to stay in the first team and to stay in the dressing room with big players. I think he can become a good player, but it's too early to give a clear assessment. But the fact that he is part of a, you know, a growing contingent of young under 21 players who are being trusted to be part of that wider squad is really, really good. And last week, De Zerbi basically said, because I asked him about Buonanotte, and he said the key to developing players is to play them. And, you know, just being in the bench and, you know, being a part of squads can only take you so far. And that's what something that I really admire about De Zerbi, the fact that he's given, you know, yesterday there was someone born 2005, a couple of 2004s, 2003s. It's just, you know, it's the kids, teenage kicks. So, yeah, it's really impressive that he's, you know, given them the trust. But I think there's that old saying, you know, doesn't, you know, matter what age you are, if you're good enough, you're old enough type thing. So, yeah, massive credit to him. And hopefully, yeah, he can kick on. I wonder what will happen with them. I think because I saw that Shannon Roof said that, you know, Brighton have had a particularly young under 21 group this season, and they still finished, I think, in the top six, which is pretty impressive. I wonder if that means some players will go on loan. But yeah, it's a very, very exciting crop of young players that Brighton have. And Hinchelwood is definitely part of that.
Yeah. And it's just as an old timey like myself, I say old timey, but you know, someone who, you know, saw, you know, the old Hinch, the older player, shall we say, it's nice to see, you know, Hinch, the younger, get his first team debut. So that was really nice. Before we talk about the post-match scenes of the players, I just want to talk about one thing, and a lot of people might be like, oh, it's only because you lost. But no, I've got to talk about it because it really frustrated me throughout the game. Just the officiating. I thought that the officiating was really, really poor. And I think that it's a wider issue. And I think that, Joe, far too often this season, we've lambasted officials, we've lambasted VAR. So to put a spin on it, Joe, what needs to become better for the sport to move forward? For me, it's consistency. And I'd like to think that Villa fans felt that the same yesterday. It was a lack of consistency. For instance, I don't understand how Matty Cash stayed on the pitch. I don't understand how he didn't get a second yellow. So for me, it's the consistency. I think in the first half, Undav got booked for something, and then a Villa player did almost exactly the same thing 10 minutes later, didn't get booked. For me, that's inconsistent, and I do not like it. So for your own peace of mind, Joe, what do the officials need to get better at next season?
What needs to be better is the officials. They're a joke in themselves. But what the fans need is, as you say, Tom, consistency, because that will mean that we don't get as frustrated as we do, and we won't be... It doesn't feel like a Premier League game if we're not sat here afterwards talking about an absolutely awful refereeing decision, does it really? It's weird when we don't mention it, and people say that is the perfect refereeing performance when you don't notice them at all, and it shouldn't be all about them. And secondly, Tom, transparency. We need to understand their decisions. A lot, you know, I'm not a football expert. I'm not, you know, I don't have coaching badges. I don't have referee badges. I don't understand each and every single rule in football. So to have the transparency actually would be really, really good for the game, because it would get so much more understanding amongst all fan bases. So I look forward to hopefully having a little bit more consistency, but we'll see. Consistency and transparency. They're the two key words for you to take away today.
I love it. Richie, you were there yesterday. Do you think I'm being a bit harsh? Because I watched that game and I was just very, very frustrated.
Nope, I don't think you're being harsh at all. I do player ratings after the game, and I was very tempted to do a player rating for him and give him like a 0 out of 10. He was just... It seems he was influenced by the crowd on occasion. So there were times when if he gave something to Brighton and then the Villa fans were up in arms, then he would give stuff just to sort of, you know, placate them. It was an amateurish performance. A lot of stuff he just got wrong, and it was disrupting the flow of the game. I understand that, you know, referees have been told to try to let the game flow a bit more, but it was too much about the, you know, the Coop show. So yeah, it's he's one of, unfortunately, I think a growing contingent of referees that just simply aren't good enough. I mean, it seems as if Howard Webb is trying to as Joe talked about, you know, trying to accountability and stuff like that to come out and apologize and be proactive. But at some point, you just think maybe these guys aren't good enough. It's a little bit like football players. You know, if they're not good enough to play in the Premier League, they don't play in the Premier League. But there's not that same kind of pool of talented referees for the Premier League. But Paul Barber, for example, has said that, you know, you can't chastise these people too much because if you have such a hostile environment, that's not going to bring potential referees in the future into the game. And therefore, if you have a game where people don't want a referee, you're going to have a smaller talent of pool to have good officials. So it's a bit of a not an easy situation. Obviously, referees do have a tough job, but you can still go, the current crop are not very good.
That's fair. I mean, and Dagan, you mentioned earlier that you felt that Brighton weren't as disciplined as they had been. Do you put some of that, not all of it, of course, do you put some of that down to the fact that perhaps players on both sides were thinking that they could get away with more? So they could put in tackles that weren't as clean, that were a bit more reckless because they thought, well, the referee's not going to blow up.
No, I do, Tom. The first thing I would say is Villa was fouling with such regularity. I mean, they were pretty much in our backs every time we received a pass. It was clear they had instruction, don't let them turn, right? Every time we fielded a pass with our back to goal, it seemed like someone was running through us. Not always with a ton of force, but enough to knock us off the ball, enough to make it difficult to turn. And I think that just led to annoyance. And so I think we committed more frustration fouls yesterday maybe than would be typical. We're just like, you know, I don't care if I kick this guy. Like, sort of ambivalence. And two, like, you know, again, if we do lose, it didn't matter. And so there wasn't a lot of risk. The thought I had overwhelmingly as I was watching later in the game was, man, if this mattered to us, this thing would have been a bloodbath. Right? I mean, because he had no control. That was clear. He had no control. And so if you had both teams caring as much as Villa cared, the level of physicality, I mean, I think we might have finished with nine guys on each team the way that game was played. And again, maybe he approaches it differently if it's a game where he knows both teams come in playing, but game management was not his strength for sure.
No, not at all. As I've already said, I was very surprised that Villa finished with 11 players and they were very lucky that Matty Cash stayed on the pitch, in my opinion. Joe, we're going to do our end of the season quiz soon. Last season, we had a question about how many times do we mention Dan Burn's name. I think this season, it's going to be how many times have we moaned about the refs and VAR. So go back through the content, people at home, so you can know the official number. But Joe, we have to talk then about the scenes after the game. Where we saw a very tearful Alexis McAllister seemingly saying his goodbyes to the fans. Very touching to watch, being consoled by Lewis Dunk. I've already said, I think it most likely was his last game for the club. So working on that assumption, Joe, what would you say to Alexis McAllister if you knew he was watching?
Please don't go. this is a guy that's put Brighton on the world map. You know, he's won the World Cup, as Dagan said, alongside his buddy Lionel Messi, who also commented on a Brighton post, which was equally as mental, which just blows my mind. And, you know, hopefully maybe we could get Lionel Messi as a replacement. That would be nice. But, you know, everything that he's given us, and I had a little sort of, not argument, but a disagreement with someone on Twitter yesterday who was saying, oh, he hasn't actually given us that much. Well, you know, this has been a guy that people have been screaming for to be in our midfield. If he's not in the team, people are up in arms. Johnny Cantor described him as one of the hardest tacklers he's seen in a Brighton shirt. And he's given everything, you know, he gives everything every single time he's wearing that Brighton shirt. And he's gone about things the right way. And for what I would say to him, I would just say thank you for respecting our football club, because he could have won the World Cup, put in a transfer request in January and been off then. He could have done a Trossard. He could have done a Kukure, but he hasn't. He stayed loyal to his contract. He stayed loyal to what he said. He wanted to get Brighton to where they deserve to be in his mind, and he's done that. So if he is to leave, if that is his last game in a Brighton shirt, he leaves with my full gratitude and my full thanks. And yeah, best of luck to wherever he goes next, because he deserves to be playing in the very, very, very highest level. And you could argue that obviously Brighton are going up those levels, and should he be a part of that with your Brighton tinted spectacles? Yeah, absolutely. He should be a part of that. But, you know, if he's only got one career, I think is what Roberto De Zerbi said. He's only got one chance to do it. So if this is his chance to move on, then thank you, Alexis, for everything you've done.
Joe, some people have been calling him a club legend. Do you think that?
It's a bit of a grey area, in my opinion. I don't think he's been here long enough to be called a club legend. The fact that he's won the World Cup whilst at our football club is monstrous. Absolutely monstrous. And he will be remembered for a very, 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 very long time. So maybe in 10 years' time, we will look back and say, yes, Alexis was a club legend. He won the World Cup whilst at our football club, came back and got us into Europe, along with everyone else. At the moment, I don't know if I would say club legend, but he's certainly in with the shout.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I don't think he's a club legend either. I have very high standards for club legendary status. But that isn't to say that I don't think what he's done for our club is truly wonderful, because it has been magnificent. He's given us some wonderful moments, but I probably wouldn't put him in that sort of defining characteristic the same
way. To let people know how high Tom's bar is, Pascal Gross has only just been deemed a club legend in his opinion. So there you go.
Hey, man, we're talking about... I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I just think the word legend is overused. I think that if a player has a good season, they're a club legend. Like, I don't see Solly March as a club legend. Not yet. If he stays here for the rest of his career, probably. Lewis Dunk is a club legend. He's a one club man. He played, what, 4 games on loan at Bristol City? He's led us from, you know, he epitomizes the idea of with Dean to Wembley. He's a club legend. When we talk about club legend, we're talking about Bobby Zamora. We're talking about Michel Kuipers. We're talking about, you know, Peter Ward. We're talking about these players that have gone on and they've just done truly magnificent things for our club, and they are era defining. I don't think Alexis McAllister is era defining. I think Pascal Gross is Premier League era defining. I wouldn't say the same as Alexis McAllister. I think he's an amazing player. I think he's one of the best players who's ever pulled on the stripes. But I don't think he's a club legend. That's just my opinion. And I don't mind if people disagree with me. That's fine. I don't really mind.
And what I hear you saying there, Tom, is you're delineating between what someone might see as like an all-time team that you might put together versus icons, legends of the club, who are sort of the face of the club, of the franchise, if you will.
Yeah, very. I mean, if you had like the best Brighton 11 of all time, Alexis McAllister's in there, won the World Cup, took us to our highest ever position in the top flight of football. There's no doubt in my mind that he doesn't belong to be in that 11. But for me, he's not in the same category as I say, Lewis Dunk, who's a one club man, who, you know, Bobby Zamora, Glenn Murray. I can't put him in that same category for me. But if others do, that's fine. Dagan, we have to talk about the possibility of another midfield maestro leaving as well. That could well be the very last time we see Moises Caicedo pull on the stripes. He wasn't as emotional at full-time as Alexis McAllister, so that brings me some little minuscule bit of hope that he wasn't as seemingly upset at, say, waving to the fans. But do you think I'm clutching at straws? Because Roberto De Zerbi's post-match comments were very much a case of, yeah, this could be the last time that we've seen them play.
I'm the moment your heart and by took note of too, right? He wasn't making that tearful farewell with, you know, De Zerbi's arms around him that we saw with McAllister. So there seemed to be a finality there that we didn't see with Caicedo. The other thing is, I think our valuation of Caicedo is such that I think it may just be dependent upon whether a club meets that valuation or not. with Caicedo. And that really may be the determining factor. And Deserve may be aware that maybe a club will pay whatever that X figure is, whether it's, you know, 90 million or 100 million or 80 million or wherever we've set that bar. So I think that's more uncertain. At least that's the hope I'm living in. You know, you guys have heard me say it a number of times. I think he's our most valuable player. I know you guys use that player of the season term, but I just think he's our most irreplaceable, most valuable. You know, Gilmore's done some great things in spot duty, and Yari has a lot of potential, and we haven't seen a ton from him yet, but I still have not seen anyone that I think approximates even remotely Caicedo. Richie's point earlier, the game changed when he was out there. And in the games where we have not had him this year, it's been rare. There have been occasions where things have clicked and we've looked good. But more often than not, we point to a lackluster performance and we say, well, Caicedo wasn't there, right? That Arsenal loss is one that stands out in my mind, where McAllister also was out, I guess, because of a suspension, and Caicedo missed. And that was calamitous, right? I mean, we looked like a completely different team. And so that's my, I guess my worry is, you know, for all the talent, and we have a ton of it, those two together were just an incredible duo, and losing both halves of that duo in one summer, just, it seems a massive risk given the season that we're facing. And again, we have a very adept gambler in charge. And so he will be weighing all of that, and we just have to trust making the right decision. And who knows, maybe there's a yet unsigned, a Stupinon level replacement for Caicedo, right? That we just have no idea we're bringing in, and he's going to come and look an upgrade from Caicedo, as unimaginable as that seems.
Yeah. Richie, perhaps a bit of an unfair question from me now. Is Caicedo harder to replace than Alexis McAllister?
I think so. I think it's nuts for me that Brighton have gone from finding a better player than Yves Bissouma. Because for me, Yves Bissouma was an absolute colossus. He just like bestride the pitch like, you know, just like none other. He was just, and then Caicedo is just, he's got more strings to his bow. And I just think, yeah, the Brighton transfer team, who have done an unbelievable job in the last few years, are going to have to even raise their game even higher to find that. I don't know if it's going to be a case of you just have a light for light replacement, or you shift the system and you have a couple of similar-ish players. But I think there was a piece recently in one of the Brighton programs with Sam Jewell, I think the sort of head of recruitment guy, and he spoke about that, you know, they tried to find the blueprint for someone similar to Bissouma, and Caicedo was that guy. But obviously they had Bissouma playing. Caicedo was on the books. It's not immediately apparent if it's an in-house solution, or would they only be able to go big and break the bank and completely change the sort of the wage structure, or the kind of how much they bid for stuff. You know, obviously João Pedro has been reported at 30 million. So that's 10 million more than Adson Webster or so. But yeah, it's for me, I think they can replace McAllister. I do wonder if it's, yeah, I think it'll be a much, much harder task with Caicedo. But obviously, I've written a number of pieces saying, I think it's a risk selling the likes of, you know, Bissouma and Cucurella in one summer, but Brighton have proven me wrong. So they keep doing that. So, and then I've argued, you know, oh, they should maybe just with a bit of insurance, they should have kept Mope or Dan Burns and stuff like that. But nope, that's fine. They keep making their pounds work harder than everyone else's. So, but yeah, I just feel this is going to be another level examination that hopefully they will pass. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting summer.
Yes, it's going to be a very interesting summer. On that point, Joe, Roberto De Zerbi had these comments to say. He said, "We are not ready to play three games per week. We have to work in the transfer market for sure to build a stronger squad with more players. We have to improve on our incredible result." We've spoken previously, Joe, about places that we need to strengthen. Do you feel like we need to strengthen all over the pitch to make next season a success?
Yeah, 100%. We need another option everywhere. The fullback situation has worried me at times this season. And especially if we're losing McAllister and Caicedo in midfield, that's going to need a huge overhaul. Obviously, we're looking at Mo Dahoud from Dortmund, who, from what I've seen of him, it's been really, really promising stuff. A lot of people have sort of labelled him as a Dortmund reject, but I don't buy that. He's played 160-odd games for them, and that's at the highest level in Germany, and that's a really good league. James Milner coming in, versatility personified. Whether people look at his age and say, oh, is he done? Is he finished? I don't think so. I think he still has a lot to offer, especially in a European competition. And then we're going to need one or two more. We've got a lot coming back from loan as well. And it's really exciting times for De Zerbi to have a full preseason with this huge array of players. Because, you know, there could be a gem out on loan that's going to really, really click with De Zerbi. Who, you know, we've seen Buonanotte coming in and Ciso coming in and have clicked so well, and he trusts them. There could be another couple of those gems. So, yeah, we've got a lot of angles to look at. And I think that puts us in a really healthy position, that we've got all of these players coming back and we're in an unbelievably healthy position going into a transfer market as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Richie, I don't know if you've kept like tabs on the Brighton loanees. Simon Adingra seems to have done very well over at USG. Kel Sherpen, we were sharing videos on our little group chat the other day. An absolute colossus in goal. Richie, do you see these players forming a part of Roberto De Zerbi's squad next season to help us deal with the four competitions that we'll be playing in?
I mean, it's an interesting one. So one player that's been mentioned, I think, as a potential backup for Caicedo is Steven Alzate. He's impressed at Standard Liège. There was an interview that he did, I think it was with The Athletic, where he basically said Gordon Greer is very happy with how he's doing. And also the roles that he's been doing at Liège would fit in pretty well at Brighton. He can play a 6, an 8 or a 10. So that's good, I guess. I've always thought there was a talent there, but I just don't think the consistency week in, week out is quite at the level that Brighton need. I think he might be a player who's for a team maybe in the bottom half of the Premier League, but especially the way that Brighton's trajectory has just skyrocketed, I just feel that he's maybe going to be left behind somewhat. I think, yeah, Adingra sounds like he's the real gem. He's been fantastic, sort of shades of Matoma. Maybe not quite as good, but he's younger. You know, he's only 21, whereas Matoma's now 26. Maybe some question marks over Andy Zaghiri. He's done pretty well out of Basel. I think Basel actually have to, if they want to exercise the loan-to-buy option, they have to do it this week. But finances might be an issue. So, interesting one there. There's also Abdulassima. He had a horrible injury spell last season. Was out for most of that time in Stoke. He's been, I think, had a better bit of a purple patch at the end of this season, but still hasn't madly impressed. Although, I think I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, Angers were by far the worst team in Ligue 1. So, I think there are some good options. I think also Kasper Kozlowski probably needs a little bit more time, maybe out somewhere. I don't think he's impressed. Sherpen, I don't know how good he is with his feet. And I think, obviously, if Sanchez, who I think most people thought was very technically gifted, isn't quite good enough for that, I don't know if Sherpen will either. I don't think Rushworth or Beeder will be given. I think they'll maybe go up on loan to maybe Rushworth in the Championship this time, maybe Beadle League 2 or League 1 just for a bit longer. So there are some decent options. I think the big one is obviously Levi Colwill. If Brighton can keep him, that's a massive boost, because I personally think that he's actually now, I think he's better than Webster. I certainly thought he was the more assured of the two centre-backs at Villa. I think for someone who's 20 and he's only had, you know, just over half a season with De Zerbi, if you have a pre-season with him, I think he could get even better. And that's pretty frightening. Chelsea will probably charge a lot of money. It'll be interesting to see, because they've got obviously their amortization stuff, so they've got these long contracts, but they will probably have to sell some of their academy products. Whether that, I don't know if maybe like if a Sanchez leaves, you know, do Brighton need to buy a goalkeeper, but then could that be a make weight for Colwell, sorry. There's just so much to discuss, you know.
And we haven't even talked about Michael Kwobovnik, who's been out on loan in the Bundesliga too, because he can play all over the pitch as well. And he's still only 20 or 21, something like that.
So he's not at Olympiakos?
No, he was last season.
He's in the second tier of Germany, so it's not the top tier. Uh-huh. I think he's kind of gone down. He's 22 now, and I think, unfortunately, I think that ship has sailed. I think you might have said, Tom, on Twitter that I was really impressed with him at Leicester away in the was it the FA Cup or the Carabao Cup? I can't remember which one it was, but and I was just thinking, oh, he's just not been played since. I think sadly, I just don't think he's got a future at Brighton, to be honest.
And that's fair. And as you say, Richie, you know, maybe if we were still in the bottom half of the Premier League, it'd be a bit different story. But we are in Europa League. Let's just take a look at some of these overview of the tables. We finished in sixth place above Spurs and Chelsea. We scored 62 points, which was 11 more points than last season. We've scored 72 goals. That's mad. Which is more than Manchester United.
That is also, Tom, a manipulated stat. How dare you? I'm joking.
No, I'm sorry.
So, Richie, I don't know if you know the backstory to that. We posted a goal-scoring stat on Twitter, which we found fascinating. Can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was a comparison between how many goals we scored under Graham Potter, how many we'd scored under De Zerbi, and somebody called it a manipulated stat. So, there you go.
Yeah. Nice. 18 wins, which is 7 more than Crystal Palace. And we've finished in the Europa League spot for next season. It has been a monumental season for Brighton Hove Albion. I predicted us to finish 8th at the start of the season. I thought we'd one up last season. To finish inside the top 6 is monumental. Gentlemen, I'm going to share with you, if I may, my Premier League predictions table that I made at the start of the season. I'm going to start at the bottom. I had Bournemouth, Fulham and Leeds to go down. Happy to say I was wrong about Bournemouth. Boy, was I wrong about Fulham. But I got Leeds right, so at least there's that. I had Forest near the bottom in 17th. I had Brentford 16th. Really wrong about that. 15th, Southampton. Everton 14th. Newcastle, I put in 13th, but that was out of spite, not necessarily because I thought they'd be that bad. But that was just purely out of spite. Palace, 12th. Villa, 11th. Wolves, 10th. Leicester, 9th. Brighton, 8th. Manchester United, 7th. West Ham, 6th. 5th, Arsenal. 4th, Spurs. 3rd, Chelsea. 2nd, Liverpool. And Manchester City running away with the title. So,
couple of those, you've had a shocker, but...
Yeah, a few. West Ham, but I do worry that we'll...
To be fair, I don't think it's you that's had the shocker. I think it's the clubs that have had the shocker. I think maybe, yeah, a lot of those clubs you would expect them to be where or there or thereabouts where you've put them. And it's just not been that way. This Premier League season has been just one of the most mental seasons of the last probably 20 years.
Yeah, it has. And in that essence then, Dagan, how important was it that we secured Europa League with the likes of Chelsea faltering, with the likes of Spurs faltering? Because this could be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
It could be. I will choose to think that it's not. That, you know, in the long view of the history of this club, this is not going to be the seminal moment, that one time we qualified for Europe. All signs are pointing upward. I think we're going to spend the summer. The hope has got to be that it gels, because we're going to be looking at 3 different teams essentially next year. We're going to have our everyday Premier League lineup, our, you know, tough Europa League lineup, our sort of lesser Europa League lineup, and then, you know, cup lineups depending upon the opponent. And that's, I think that's what Deserby's alluding to. But it's obviously gratifying to be in the top six. It's an amazing accomplishment. I'm gonna point back to four games into the season. In the middle of the fourth game, I alluded to this earlier, we were at the top of the table. And so much was made about that was nothing. But I went back and looked at that snapshot. Eight of the top 10 teams at that moment finished in the top 10. The two that dropped out were Chelsea, that dropped to 12th, and Leeds, that did drop all the way down to the bottom, but they went through a series of managers. And I think if they kept Jesse March, I don't think they go down. You know, I think hindsight is that was a poor decision. Hastily made one where they were aiming to get back up near the top and instead fired themselves all the way down to the bottom. And the only two teams that moved into the top 10 that were not in it previously were Brentford and then Villa, who obviously hired Emery and then just, you know, launched to the stratosphere. These are no more aberrations than those first four games were, I think is what I'm getting at with that. Like, this Brighton team is Brighton right now. And again, 5 years from now, we may look back and things have changed. And I was listening to a pundit yesterday who I guess has ties to Leicester that was saying, you know, if you had told me, you know, what we would go through as a club and that we would go down at this point, I'd take it. Right. And so I just don't see that turnabout being immediate for us. Maybe sometime in the future, we're going to go down. But right now, I think we're riding an incredible wave that we're going to keep riding upward. At least that's my belief. That's what brought me here. And now that I'm here, I love everything else. But I came for the W's. Like, people didn't believe me, but I was here to ride this colossal wave. They do come down eventually, but I'm not expecting that anytime soon.
And on that note of wonderful optimism from Dagan, we bring the show to a close. Thank you, viewers and listeners, for joining us this season. We've still got some wonderful content to come at you. We are going to do our season in review very soon, so keep an eye out for that. We'll do our end of season quiz. We've got some big plans for the end of season quiz, and we're going to try and get the other Brighton and Hove Albion podcasters involved as well. So that should be really exciting. We're also going to do a With Dean Years watch along with myself and Aaron. So lots of really great off-season stuff still to come. Thank you very much to Joe, Dagan and Richie for joining me today. Thank you very much to the rest of the Albion Obsessed team throughout there for the hard work throughout the season. It has been the best season to be a Brighton supporter, one that I certainly never thought I'd ever see. So thank you very much, listeners and viewers. It's been an absolute roller coaster and it has been an absolute honour and a pleasure. So wherever you may be, whenever you may be, we'll see you next time. Take care, guys.